Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we dive beneath the headlines on the biggest story of the week. Last night, after 11 months of investigation, the House committee tasked with investigating the events on January 6, 2021, began presenting their case to the public, and it took us right back to that fateful day.
The Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol will be in order.
And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
We've been told and there have been spotted protesters are inside the Capitol building.
Multiple Capitol entries! Multiple Capitol entries!
Guess what? America showed up!
We're here! If I give this up, they're going to have direct access. At least this Capitol we can defend. We got to hold what we have.
We've had a disbursement of tear gas in the rotunda. Please be advised to mask under your seats.
This is now effectively a riot.
1349 hours declaring it a riot.
This was a fraudulent election, but we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you. You're very special.
We will bring you these hearings home to Massachusetts, as we have with the events of January 6th since it happened. Here's Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern and former U.S. Attorney from Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling.
I came face to face with this angry group of rioters or terrorists, whatever you want to call them. 140 Capitol Police officers were injured that day. People died. And if they and they tried to undermine the election. So when people are trying to downplay it or make believe it didn't happen, it really ticks me off. I mean, I have no patience for that.
I think you saw the system respond quickly and decisively to hold accountable the people who breached the Capitol. I think the public had faith in the system working there, and I think those cases have been resolved for the most part proportionally.
Last night was the first of many hearings, with more scheduled for next week and the rest of the month.
There is no room for debate. Those who invaded our Capitol and battled law enforcement for hours were motivated by what President Trump had told them, that the election was stolen and that he was the rightful president. President Trump summoned the mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack.
I was called a lot of things on January 6, 2021, and the days thereafter. In actuality, I was none of those things. I was an American, standing face to face with other Americans, asking myself how many times, many, many times, how we had gotten here.
I documented the crowd turn from protesters to rioters to insurrectionists. I was surprised at the size of the group, the anger and the profanity. And for anyone who didn't understand how violent that event was, I saw it, I documented it, and I experienced it.
The American people deserve answers. So I come before you this evening, not as a Democrat, but as an American who swore an oath to defend the Constitution.
Voices there last night from the committee and the live witnesses. Now here to help us dig into what happened, what it means for our Commonwealth, former Massachusetts Congressman Mike Capuano and retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Congressman, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Tiziana.
And Judge Gertner, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
So I want to be mindful of something as we start this conversation. You are both arguably progressive voices. Congressman, you're a Democrat. Part of the criticism, especially the Republican criticism of these hearings, is that they're political rather than substantive. Our reasoning that putting the two of you together today is less to litigate the legitimacy of the committee, though probably touch on that. More to get perspective from two people that we know can make things understandable and who can bring deep experience with Congress and with the law. So for listeners, that's what we're doing here. And in that space, I want to begin with your reactions from last night, Congressman.
Pretty much like anybody watched them or anybody who's thought about this for 2 seconds. I mean, this has nothing to do with politics per se. I've been involved in deep philosophical debates and emotions all my adult life through the political process, arguing people, screaming at people, having them scream and yell, argue with me. But I've never once thought that there'd be people who would want to just completely ignore the Constitution and the basic bedrock of democracy and overturn elections. I've won and I've lost. Winning is better. It's more fun. But losing is part of the democratic process. And if you're not willing to lose, you really shouldn't put your name on the ballot. And if you don't respect that, I can't think of anything more un-American than disrespecting the ballot box.
Judge Gertner.
Well, I was chilled by the language that seemed entirely justified by the facts that were presented. When Liz Cheney said this is a coup, this was an attempted coup, and make no mistake about it, and put the events of January 6th in the context of Trump's other efforts from the beginning to deal with the Georgia Secretary of State, to be dealing with the Georgia Secretary of State and the other state and local officials to set aside the election. I mean, it was chilling. When you put all of it together in the same pot, it is an attempted coup. It is simply an attempted coup.
In legal history, Judge Gertner, have we had another attempted coup in the United States?
Nothing like this. People focus on January 6th, and there's a way in which the January 6th pictures, even those of last night, you can be dulled to it because of the numbers of times that you had seen it, even though they were presenting new footage. But what is new about this was the what they had put together with respect to Trump's relationship to those events, and more significantly even, putting January 6th in the context of everything else he was doing to set aside the election. And chillingly, knowing that there was nothing wrong with the election, knowing from his family, from Barr, from his counsel, that in fact there was nothing wrong with the election. So putting it all together, it was an attempted coup.
And so for listeners who may not have seen, there were several video clips from previous testimony of the kinds of people that you just mentioned, Judge Gertner, saying that they had said to the president or personally held the belief that there was nothing wrong with the election and that, you know, any data arguing that it was a false outcome was, in fact, false itself. Go ahead.
No, I mean, and that's really key here. It's key to moral responsibility, political responsibility, but it's also key to legal responsibility here, because it is, if he thought the election was fraudulent in good faith and did borderline illegal stuff to accomplish that, that's one thing, but he knew that the election was fine.
So
he knew that the election was not tainted.
So, Congressman, with those things in front of us, you know, Lynn Cheney arguing this is an attempted coup, Judge Gertner saying what they laid out matters legally, what is the job of Congress right now, and what is the job of our congressional delegation who sit sort of to the side of what's happening right now?
Well, I think our congressional delegation, from everything I've heard, is on the right side of this and historically what their requirements are. I hope that Congress not just does the hearings. I still believe that President Trump should be held criminally responsible for his activities. They were beyond the scope of being a president, and he should be held to account. Look, I want to be clear. I thought the election between Al Gore and George Bush was stolen, but Al Gore took all kinds of legal remedies, which he's entitled to take with recounts and going to courts and making sure. But that was within the realm of acceptability. And I don't even mind that Donald Trump really believed that the election was stolen from him, which, of course, I don't agree with. But again, there are legal remedies for that. He exercised, from what I know, everything he could exercise and still lost because the courts didn't hold that they were – if whatever problems he might have thought there were, they didn't fall within the realm of the courts. And we're not talking about Massachusetts courts. We're talking Florida, Georgia, places that – you know, in theory, people that more agree with Donald Trump's view of the world might be more likely to be judges and in juries. So all that being said, I draw the line between the concern about Donald Trump and his supporters and wanting to win the election. Fine. Doing everything you can to make sure that, in your opinion, the election is fair and honest. Fine. There are ways to do that. There are legal ways to do that. And they have been exercised before, and they will and should be exercised in the future. It was the attempt to use force to undermine the election that, to me, is the only real troubling item here. I won't say the only one, but the most important one. And again, the president's urging them on. And the president then, even worse than that, I mean, again, urging him on, you know, he uses all kinds of wonderful, interesting little terms that maybe I didn't say this, maybe I said that. But then sitting silently by while it was happening, and he was getting calls and urgings from his own family members to take action and still refusing to take action, just tells me, obviously, that the earlier actions are probably more indictable than even those who want to give him the benefit of the doubt think. And let's be honest, Attorney General Barr and I don't see eye to eye on probably anything other than this. Liz Cheney, I served with her. She's a wonderful person, but we don't see eye to eye on almost anything politically, but I give her incredible credit for standing up for what's right. And again, I have no doubt, I don't even know if she said it publicly, I would be shocked if she did not vote for Donald Trump for president in that particular election. And her candidate probably lost. Again, I don't know how she voted, but I guess that. She still accepted the ballot. That's the way America is supposed to function. And does. So it's not like you don't have legal remedies if you think your election has been stolen or has somehow miscounted ballots or whatever else you want to claim. There are plenty of them. They're exercised every election cycle. Somebody exercises those rights. Some of them win. Some of them lose.
So in reference to one thing you said, again, for listeners who may not have seen the hearing last night, one of the sort of sets of evidence that was presented were arguments that Vice President Mike Pence took several steps to try to step up security and provide support to the Capitol Police, but that then President Trump, did not, and that his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, had much more of a political view of what was going on versus a safety and security view. I want to start to bring this home now to Massachusetts, and I have a couple questions for both of you. Again, you're listening to Radio Boston. We're talking to retired federal judge Nancy Gertner and former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano, analyzing the January 6th hearings and what it means for here in the Commonwealth. Morning Edition host Rupa Shenoy here asked me a really interesting question this morning. It's a hypothetical, but I sure didn't know the answer. Judge Gertner, I'll turn to you first for the legal side. Had this, we're using the word coup, it's what the committee used last night, had a coup succeeded, what would Massachusetts's legal options and responses have been?
That's an extraordinary question. If a coup had succeeded, we would be in very different territory than we have ever been. I mean, Trump would have declared himself, I mean, presumably would have declared himself the victor. What would Massachusetts have done? No, I mean, I think that the only model, and this is really speculation, is, you know, the Civil War. I mean, is, you know, is secession. I mean, that's an extraordinary question, because if Pence had rejected the Electoral College votes that had been duly certified and sent it back to the state legislatures, that was the proposal, that was the Eastman proposal, and the state legislatures, largely controlled by Republicans, in the key states, in the battleground states, had said, oh, yes, Trump is the president. We are now off the constitutional page. We are now we're in a very different territory. What could Massachusetts do? At that point, you're in rebellion. You're in, right? I mean, yes, you could have gone to the courts, but who knows what the courts would have done? Lurking, this is a little bit inside baseball, in Republican talking points now is the notion that only the state legislatures have the right to determine the election outcomes, not state courts and certainly not federal courts. So would our Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, have said, well, state legislatures have the right to do this, and therefore Trump is president?
Who knows?
So that's fascinating.
But I think you're talking about chaos. You're talking about, you're really talking about something in which the, I mean, this goes back to Mike Capuano's comment. This, you're talking about a situation now in which the Constitution is no longer playing a role.
So that,
so it's chaos.
That is fascinating, Congressman. And part of what intrigues me about what Judge Gertner just said was, I assumed then my question to you is, so what does our congressional delegation do in that scenario? But maybe it's what our state legislature does in that scenario.
The congressional delegation would not be a congressional delegation. America would be dead. It'd be the end of the country. And each state and each group and each within each state would be in chaos. We wouldn't be the first country to fall into that situation. My hope is it doesn't happen for a long, 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 long time. That scenario also presumes that the military would follow a dictator. I always believed that the U.S. military, they also take an oath to the Constitution. They do not take an oath to Donald Trump.
Any president.
Or to any president. They take an oath to the United States Constitution. I believe that the U.S. military is run by honorable men. I mean, again, I can disagree with policies here and there, but I still think that when everything's said and done, the understanding that democracy is really what it's all about, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, I think it's pretty clear. And if any coup succeeded, this one or one tomorrow, it's the end of the country. Kind of simple. What happens after that? I think that's a question for the ages, for any country, any time there is a falling out. It has happened before in other places. It will happen again someplace tomorrow, somewhere, who knows where. Hopefully not here and not forever.
Judge Gertner, is there anything about what is likely to come forward or has come forward in the hearings that affects the prosecutions of people in the New England region who have been accused of breaking the law in the ways that they participated on January 6th?
I don't think that it affects the existing cases, because what the Department of Justice has done, it's very interesting. The Department of Justice has worked is from the bottom up, presumably, and the committee is working from the top down in a way. Let me explain. So they've identified individuals, the Department of Justice identified individuals, including people in New England, who did more than just attend the rally on January 6th, but who participated in the insurrection. You know, the people who were violent, the people who had obviously, as with the Proud Boys, were intending to do something else, engaging in seditious conspiracy, meaning attempting to interfere with the lawful workings of the government. So they've started with the people that they could identify and then tried to broaden it, if they could, to who else was conspiring with them. The criminal law is, you know, a very detailed focus. I mean, who conspires with them is not just, hey, Trump thought it was a good idea, but who was in touch with them. Nothing that I saw would change those prosecutions, because you don't have Trump calling the head of the Proud Boys and saying, hey, break into the Capitol directly. You don't have him doing that directly. So I don't see that affecting those prosecutions. The committee is another situation, and the question is what has come out of the committee deliberations that could affect prosecution of Trump.
Of the president.
Of the president, right, of the former president. I mean, that's because they started with his relationship to the insurrection and then his relationship to the efforts to undermine the electors, to come up with a different slate of electors in each of the states. His relationship, they want to put, it's more than just he encouraged people to come to the Capitol on that day. He was, from the minute of the election, seeking to undermine it in all sorts of ways.
I just want to jump in. I mean, again, watching yesterday's hearing, it came home to me again. Many, not all, but many of the people that showed up at that so-called rally came with Ahmed helmets and bulletproof vests. One of the persons that was shown just yesterday on this videotape was one of those guys now saying, well, I came because the president called me. Well, that's fine. They had then showed a picture of him with an army helmet and a bulletproof vest on, and he got 29 months of probation. I'm sorry. I know people that have gotten a lot worse sentences for a lot less crime than insurrection. I haven't followed the details of who's getting what punishment, but I would argue that if you were convicted of insurrection against the United States of America, against the United States Constitution, that you should be imprisoned. Simple. Particularly when you come, it's not like you get caught up in the moment, and that's fine. That happens. I understand that. But when you come with a helmet, when you come with a weapon, when you come with a bulletproof vest.
None of them came with weapons.
Well, I would suggest that a bat is a weapon. I would suggest that bear spray is a weapon. They came with some, certainly, maybe they didn't come with guns. Maybe they did.
Right.
I don't know that. But there are lots of different weapons to use in a full-scale riot and full-scale insurrection. Not every farmer on July, during the Lexington Lexington battle had a gun. Some of them had pitchforks. And all I'm saying is that it bothered me yesterday to see some of those guys only with probation, when I personally know people that have gotten many-year sentences for what I would consider significantly less crimes.
Judge Gertner, last word to you.
I think that's a fair point about how we throw the book at people for lesser crimes. The problem here was that the DOJ's focus was very narrow. And you know, the question was what individuals did, and what they intended to do, what they attempted to do. And the question is whether they had that kind of information with respect to individuals. And sometimes they did, maybe certainly with the Proud Boys. You're seeing that now with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. Yes, they had information with respect to those people. The other problem is that the statutes, and this is something that the Select Committee needs to look at, the statutes are actually very limited. It goes from sort of misdemeanor breaking into a public building to seditious conspiracy and nothing in between. Seditious conspiracy is not easy to prove. And taking Mike's point, and, you know, breaking into a public building is too little. They really only had those alternatives, and the judge likewise only had those alternatives. But the broader question for the committee, it seems to me, is not only how to change the legislation with respect to the Capitol and insurrections in the Capitol, but what all of this shows about weaknesses in our electoral system, what all of this shows about what an intentional actor who means to effect a coup could have done. And that's why the Select Committee's work is not just about who did what on January 6th, but who could do what in 2024.
All right.
And that's the significance of it.
Retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner and former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano, thanks to both of you. I appreciate your help today.
Thank you.
Visceral response when I hear that music. It is wedding season, folks. Anyone who has been down that aisle or helped someone else walk down that aisle knows that wedding planning is a lot. And you know it can be expensive. According to TheKnot.com, Massachusetts is one of the most expensive states to get married in. In 2021, wedding costs averaged, wait, $42,000 in the Commonwealth. That does include the cost of the ring. What you might not know is that weddings have substantial environmental impact, or they can. And three local businesses are trying to change that and keeping an eye on keeping things affordable. We're joined by Molly Wolfberg-Swartz, the founder and owner of Glow Bridal in Newton, Nikki Bartley, founder and owner of Cross Street Flower Farm in Norwell, and John Lawrence, co-owner and co-founder with his wife of Pepper's Artful Events in Northborough. So let's say hello to each of you. Molly, welcome.
Thank you so much.
John, great to have you.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
And Nikki, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're all here in Studio 2, folks, and I just want to start by asking why weddings aren't sustainable. Catering, flowers, dresses, what are the environmental impacts? Molly, let's start with dresses.
Totally. So the nature of a wedding is not sustainable, right? It's one day. You're spending all this money on all of these items for about 12 hours.
Although one hopes that the marriage is sustainable, just
most definitely,
not the wedding day.
I think, exactly, exactly. So I think the nature of a wedding is not sustainable. So inherently, you know, we just are doing a lot for just one day.
Yeah. And anything specific about the dresses that strikes you?
Yes, absolutely. So creating any garment is not very sustainable. For example, one dress can take up to 2,300 gallons of water to create. So there's a lot of environmental impact when thinking about garments, and especially a garment that you wear, again, for 12 hours, even if you do save it and you pass it along. So the creation of fashion right now especially can be very not sustainable.
So, Jen, let's turn to catering. What might we not think about that, you know, I think people think about things like plastic plates and forks, you know, throwing away dishes if you're doing that kind of wedding versus a china and silver and glasses. But what else on the catering side can make a wedding unsustainable or have harsh environmental impact?
Well, I mean, you think just bar services, you know, how many bottles and bottles of beer and wine and what have you that you bring. And at the end of the day, there's, you know, 50-gallon trash bags, you know, 8, 10, 12 of them, what have you, you know. We switched over to rolling beer walls, and now we only pour craft beer. That eliminated all of our bottles and cans and recycling and all that aspect of it. But our company is green by its nature, so the way we produce our own solar hot water, our solar energy and what have you. So we're green before anyone even asks us to be green. You know, that's our foundation.
So, Nikki, at first blush with flowers, one might think, okay, well, they're flowers, right? They can't be a problem. And yet there are better and worse ways to source flowers to be environmentally sustainable.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big picture is that 80% of flowers are imported into our country. And if you just think about that, the environmental impact of flying flowers in, you have jet fuel, packaging, water, tons of waste, and not to mention the chemicals that are used on those flowers when they're grown on other farms. So, and then take it one step further, once the florists have it in their hand, a lot of times less sustainable practices would be to use floral foam, which is has a lot of chemicals in it.
And that's so, that green spongy stuff
exactly,
that you stick the flowers in?
Exactly. So I think a movement towards more sustainable flowers looks at using local flowers, flowers that don't have that transport. And also, we don't use floral foam in any of our designs. We use a coated chicken wire and just straight in the vessel with water.
So the three of you, and you can jump in all together on this one if you want. Do you find that your customers are looking for this, are thinking about this, or are they mostly cost conscious at this point, or is it both and? What do you find?
I've found, at least in the wedding dress industry, it's a little bit of both. People are definitely looking for used consignment dresses to try to save a little bit of money, but also be very conscious consumers and feel good about kind of where they are putting their dollars. But we do have a lot of people who walk in the door that just want to feel really good about where they're spending their money and know that if they're going to buy a $2,000 or $3,000 dress, that it was made with ethical and fair labor, that they're kind of getting the least amount of waste that they can possibly with this garment. So we do find that sustainability has become a really big top priority for brides.
And the movement is more to use a dress a second time or repurpose a dress?
It's either or. It's either purchase something brand new from people they can feel good about and designers they can feel good about, or purchase something secondhand and know that they kind of did the right thing that way too.
So John, you know, co-founder of Pepper's Artful Events, I was thinking about Nikki talking about, well, locally sourcing the flowers makes a difference. Do people come in thinking about the environmental impact of their catering, wanting, let's say, locally sourced food? Or are they more worried about cost? What do you find is the balance?
Well, that's a great question. So a combination of both. I mean, first of all, our clients are often asking us about our green practices and our sustainable practices. So who are we as a company? And they may, you know, the budget is, you know, there's so many ways in which the budgets can go sideways with wedding planning. And we give our clients the choices, you know, and we let them know how our green practices, and many of them are just satisfied with that. And they're going to go on and plan the wedding the way they wish to have it, what have you. So we're not using the bamboo plates and all of the other compostable products on every wedding. It's a client's choice. Those products come at a little bit of a premium price point. But we, you know, we have German engineered dishwashing machine. So if you're using our dishes, automatically those are, it's more sustainable the way we handle washing our products, what have you. You know, so our clients feel very good about that. But
kind of the dishwasher equivalent of using chicken wire instead
yes.
of floral.
Exactly,
foam.
Exactly. Yes.
And Nikki, that's part of the game here, right? And I don't mean that in a silly way. I mean, that's part of the point is if you build a business that can serve any wedding, regardless of whether the person, holding the wedding or organizing the wedding is thinking from a sustainability standpoint, you can bake it in to the way you do your work.
Exactly. I think it's a lot about education. Honestly, it's so much of weddings is driven by images. Brides may not be flower lovers or have the idea of what they want their dress to look like, but Pinterest and social media has, you know, as soon as a bride gets engaged, they start to create these Pinterest boards, and then they know, you know, they pick their palettes that they want. But on those pictures, it doesn't say, oh, this isn't a bouquet that was made from flowers grown in New England in June. You know, it's likely from somewhere else. So it's about educating the brides that, you know, if they're interested in sustainability, they're going to have to dig a little deeper and look at that picture and say, okay, you may not be able to get this peony in October.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. Just yesterday, we did a gardening segment here on the show where we talked about, you know, New England weather, New England gardening zones, and what you can and can't plant, what will work, et cetera. It didn't occur to me, but if you are doing sustainable local growing of flowers, then you are limited in some ways to what will grow and seasonally thrive outdoors in the ground here in New England.
Exactly. And our flower farm is local flowers, and our season starts in April when the daffodils start blooming, and it goes through first frost, which mm-hmm. is, you know, usually mid to late October with the dahlias. And our customers have learned what is blooming in those months. They kind of follow along with us in the journey of the seasons, and it's connecting them back to nature, but also to understanding how flowers have been for millennia, you know, that people really, for cultural or spiritual practices, would just go out in their gardens and meadows and orchards and harvest what they could find and make bouquets and use them for botanical reasons or for events. So it's bringing that back as
so
well,
you can
that
bring
connection.
That back. Yeah. Yes. And John, do you try to when you can, or are you asked to locally source food? And does that change what you can put on a menu for a wedding if you do so?
It's not limiting. It's quite exciting, actually. I mean, I regularly go to a farm over in Berlin, the next town over, and speak with the farmer. What's coming on? What's we doing? I put most of that information into our Farmer in the Fork Cafe that we run over at the New England Botanical Gardens at Tower Hill, but there's, you know, when, you know, rhubarb is coming out right now, so we're doing rhubarb mustarda on our smoked turkey sandwiches, and the turkey comes from North Country smokehouses in Vermont, you know. So I think I find it quite exciting, to be honest with you, instead of trying to source, you know, some special smoked paprika from Spain, what have you. You know, what do we got local? And, you know, our clients definitely resonate with all of those kind of options.
So what about you, Molly? So two questions. One, I'm assuming, I'm realizing, I'm imagining you can get a dress from anywhere.
Yes.
Although shipping that dress then has a carbon footprint to it.
Totally.
And then there are the designers, right? We have done segments here on the show before about whether or not Massachusetts is a designer mecca, mm-hmm. And where we are in our, you know, in sort of the fashion landscape. So easier, harder, doesn't matter because yours is a global market. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I hyper-focus on North American designers by choice, knowing that they have a lot of control over where they source their materials, how they produce, how they kind of create their excess waste. So when you're coming to Glow Bridal, you're mainly shopping either consignment wedding dresses that could have been created overseas, or you're shopping made to order dresses by designers who kind of prioritize all the same things that we do within the store. So this kind of can go from they're making sure that they could drive to get their materials. They're creating all their liners with scraps from their other dresses. They're making sure that it's kind of fair, well-paid, ethical labor. Labor is a big kind of component of sustainability. It's not just kind of how things are created and how that impacts the environment. We do think there's a large ethical component to that as well. So We at GLOW are only sourcing in North America, so you know that you can kind of feel really good about nothing is being flown in from overseas, and we're prioritizing that with our designers. And a lot of our designers are in New England as well.
Okay, we're talking with Molly Swartz, founder and owner of GLOW Bridal, Nikki Bartley, founder and owner of Cross Street Flower Farm, and John Lawrence, co-founder and co-owner of Pepper's Artful Events, about sustainable weddings. We're getting close to the end here. I want to do a lightning round now. So the question is, one easy, affordable thing that you can do for your wedding that will make it a little more sustainable in the worlds that you work in. So Nikki, one easy, affordable thing in flowers.
DIY buckets. We offer them, and they have 8 to 10 bunches of flowers, and we say they make 6 to 8 mason jars, so bridal parties can, together the night before the wedding or rehearsal dinner, make their bouquets and save money and have fun together, be joining together in the celebration.
Excellent. John, how about with catering?
With catering, the same thing, seasonal. You know, ask for items that on the menu that are in season and local right now to reduce our carbon footprint, so I can go to the local farmers and say, hey, this is what our clients are interested in. And, you know, don't ask for blueberries in January. You know, let's go do blueberries in July when they're coming out. They're easily the price is a bit more reasonable, but the flavor profile, because it hasn't been transported or picked before, it was perfectly ripe. So eat in season.
And Molly?
Work a family heirloom into your wedding look. So whether that be a mother or grandmother's veil, a piece of jewelry, you can work with your bridal store and your bridal stylist to kind of focus in on what makes sense so you can reuse a little bit there.
Okay, last lightning round question. Molly, we'll come back in the reverse direction. Coolest or most fun sustainable thing you've ever done for somebody preparing for a wedding?
Yes, we, similar to what I just said, we worked lace from a grandmother's gown into the train of a bride's dress, and it was really special.
John, how about you?
I love the opportunity that our clients present us when they want themes, whether it's to be a lavender theme or a bee theme, you know, et cetera. And our clever design teams will put together, you know, faux bee, you know, beehives, you know, and many different things that really just help bring the event together. And we work with our collaborators, you know, our partners, if you will, the florists and other event planners, or to bring it all together. But yeah, anything that's natural, fresh, and local, you know, it just all works together, and we enjoy those opportunities.
Nikki, how about you?
We once had a mother of a bride come and volunteer with us when we were planting our dahlia tubers in May, right after Mother's Day, and then the tubers she helped to plant were in her daughter's bouquet, bridal bouquet.
And you were able to really ensure that the ones she helped plant were in the bridal bouquet?
Yeah. I mean, well, we grow 10,000 dahlias, mm-hmm. so, but yeah, I'm pretty sure she was in the peaches and there were peach dahlias in her daughter's bouquet.
Oh, that's fun. Okay, mm-hmm. So Nikki Bartley is of Cross Street Flower Farm, Molly Wolfberg-Swartz is of GLOW Bridal, and John Lawrence is of Pepper's Artful Events. Thanks for joining us to talk about sustainable weddings. Appreciate it from all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
We made it, folks. Like always, we are bringing you a guide to the best of what's local this weekend. And we have to start, of course, with the Celtics game tonight. Game 3 of the NBA Finals was on Wednesday. It was at the TD Garden, and the Celtics turned the tables after a miserable loss in Game 2.
Curry, Grant Williams on him. Curry makes his move, gets in the paint, throws it up, blocked by Williams. His fourth projection of the game.
That's Robert Williams turning the tables on Steph Curry on Wednesday night with that block. So tonight the question is what to watch for, and will the Celtics actually win 2 in a row and expand their lead, getting one step closer to the first finals win since 2008, or are the Warriors going to step back up, bring us back 2-2? Joining us now, Kyrie Thompson. He is a sports writer for WEEI, a Celtics fan, former colleague. Welcome, Kyrie. Oops, I think we may have lost Kyrie's sound. And if we did, that is okay, because we can come back to the Celtics.
I am back.
There you
Sorry
are, Kyrie.
Hey, Tiziana,
what are you doing scaring me like that?
My apologies. I know how stressful it's got to be on a live show.
It's great to have you. So, Kyrie, first, just quickly, biggest highlight for you from Game 3 Wednesday night?
Honestly, it was Robert Williams coming back. And, I mean, you know, I know he's hurt, but he really helped change the game. And honestly, I think that once again, the you know, Celtics just withstood one of those runs and you know, kind of one of those performances that the Golden State Warriors have done to so many teams, where you had Steph Curry and Klay Thompson playing well. And in the end, it didn't matter because the Celtics just kept their cool and powered on through. And I think that that is one of the amazing things about the Celtics team, based on where they were at the midpoint of the season when no one really thought they had a chance to be where they are now.
Okay, so I do feel a little, Kyrie, like this team has kind of messed with us, right? They'll have a strong game. You look at the Miami series. We win, we lose, we win, we lose, we win, we win. Do you think we can sustain it for another night tonight?
Ultimately, yes. And I think that some of the evidence was there in this past game, where I think that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown at a certain point just realized, wow, these guys can't guard us and we're just going to go at them. And I think that aggressiveness is something that I'm going to hope that they you know, continue to have tonight. It is kind of worrisome that, you know, Ime Udoka, after some of these losses, continually has to be like, Yeah, where Ime Udoka continues to continually, you know, tell his players, like, look, will you guys like start stepping up and quit, you know, like sagging behind and keep that intensity? And I think that this is probably going to be a game where Coach Udoka tells them, like, look, this is it. Do this now, and you put yourself in the driver's seat, and you're probably going to win the series.
Okay, one other thing I do want to touch on, complaints about the Celtics fan behavior, especially towards Draymond Green, who played, I think we'll call it, a very physical game on game two, but then got shut down by an aggressive Celtics team Wednesday night. I want to play a little bit of that.
Green and Williams going face to face again.
And there's some pushing going on here.
In game two in San Francisco, Grant Williams is young, but he's not one to hold back talking.
So a lot of back and forth. We've got a history of bad behavior at the Garden. Do you have reactions to those complaints and thoughts about what to expect tonight?
I mean, I'll say this. I've been to two playoff games this year, and one of them was actually game one against Brooklyn, where they were really going at Kyrie Irving. And, you know, my name being Kyrie, that didn't feel very good.
Oh, yeah.
But all in all, I mean, I think that this is something that happens around the NBA. And I don't know that this is something that is, you know, markedly more horrible in Boston than it is in other places. I also think that the Warriors in the past have excused that kind of behavior from their own fans. So I don't think that it was anything particularly egregious, even if it is a little bit, you know, intense and, you know, perhaps a little bit, you know, over the top, maybe with some of the manufactured hatred. At the same time, I think that it's the Golden State Warriors are upset because they are getting punched in the mouth by a team that's tougher than them, honestly. And it's only going to get worse in game four. So, I mean, if they thought that this was going to be, they were going to garner any sympathy from anyone by talking about the language or what the Celtics fans were saying, like, that is absolutely not going to be the case. It is going to be even louder and even more angry and jeering at the Garden tonight.
All right. With that, WEEI reporter Kyrie Thompson. Kyrie, thanks for setting us up for tonight.
Thank you very much.
All right. So that's Friday night. But what else can you do this weekend after you watch the Celtics, or if you're one of those instead of watching the Celtics? Cristela Guerra, WBUR senior arts and culture reporter, is here with some suggestions. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you have several things, and you're going to start with music, right?
Yeah. So BAMS Fest. It's one of my favorite events. It's the Boston Art and Music Soul Festival. It celebrates Black artistry, Afrocentric identity. The theme this year is Epic Joy. After several difficult years, you'll have minority-owned businesses. One of my favorite parts is that they have live murals happening, so just massive canvases with painters and graffiti artists painting, kites, music, 12 to 6, Franklin Park in Dorchester.
That actually sounds fantastic. And that's tomorrow?
Yes, Saturday.
Okay. It's also Pride Month, and I know you've brought us a couple of different ways to celebrate Pride this weekend. Let's start with Pop-Up Pride.
So I'm going to just be in rainbows all weekend. I just need everybody to know this. Pop-Up Pride Sunday. So 11 to 5 on the Common. It's something different. After the Boston Pride disbanded in 2021, the city hasn't had a parade technically in around 3 years. But I think what you're seeing among just the queer community, the LGBTQ community, is taking hold of it and nourishing something new. I think we're seeing a grassroots effort. We're going to see families come together. I'm hearing music, just a lot of celebratory stuff that isn't necessarily corporate-backed. This is going to be very grassroots.
And where will this be on Sunday?
On Boston Common, starting at 11 a.m.
And this, I do want to underscore, this really does mark a moment. We covered the disbanding of Boston Pride last summer, and it was over issues of inclusion, trans recognition, voices of color, new leadership. This really does mark a new moment for Boston.
It does. It allows the community to imagine what it would look like if we were always included, considering that Black and brown queer folks began at Stonewall. They started the movement. So we know trans women of color began this movement, and we should always include everybody. And love is love.
So you also brought us another Pride event, and this time going to the theater in Pride Month.
Yeah. So it's called the, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing this properly, Amigon at Pow Arts Center in Boston's Chinatown. Mm-hmm. It's a story circle for queer people of color, specifically queer Muslims, to talk about family, love, prayer, healing. It's going to be sort of an opportunity, I think, to share stories. So people should sort of come prepared to be vulnerable. And it's actually tonight, Saturday and Sunday.
Okay. And I was interested in this because it's an adaptation of Antigone. And so I was also wondering, are we going to say Amigone or Amigon? But it's Amigon, and it's in Pow Arts Center.
I actually could be completely inaccurate and incorrect about this.
Yeah.
And I should call Micah to ask.
Well, we're all intrigued. Anybody who goes, email us or tweet us at Radio Boston and let us know how we were supposed to pronounce it. Okay.
Please.
It's also a great time of year for festivals. You and I were talking before during the break about just how glorious this weather is. So take us to a festival.
So first, Framingham. It's the ninth annual Metro Fest at the Bowditch Athletic Cultural Complex. 11 a.m. to 4. I think I've heard classic cars, antiques, farm animals. It's kid-friendly. I think people just have something to do all day with their family members and loved ones.
And that's on Saturday, tomorrow?
It is, from
okay.
11 to 4.
And is that one free, do you know?
I believe a lot of it is, yeah. I think it's just going to be folks out at the festival. There'll be food trucks and stuff like that.
Fantastic. And mm-hmm. You've got another one, another festival for us, too.
So Worcester, it's its 300th birthday. It's tercentennial. And that's going to be all
Who
weekend.
Knew?
I did not.
I didn't either.
I didn't. Worcester looks so good for 300. There's a 5K. There's a parade. I'm hearing that the best place to watch is Main Street from School Street to City Hall. Fireworks, live music. But there's going to be events every day. Folks can look up the Tercentennial's website.
And I think tomorrow's supposed to be beautiful. So
yeah.
Yeah. So how about you? What are you going to do this weekend? You said you're going to be wrapped in a pride flag.
All of it.
Yeah.
I want to go to BAMS Fest. I want to go to Pop-Up Pride. I just want to see what people are doing, how they're feeling, and what it is to be just, you know, queer and free in the summer day.
And I want to bring this back around because people didn't hear this during the break, but you and I were talking about the fact that first time we did this, you talked about how much laying in the grass gives you joy. And you've actually been doing that, right?
Like every weekend.
Yeah, me too. And it really does make you feel better.
So it's scientifically proven.
There you go. So folks, if you're listening, lay in the grass this weekend, probably Saturday. It may rain Sunday. So if you don't want to get wet, try it on Saturday. That's Cristela Guerra, WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter. Love having you here on Fridays. Thanks.
Thanks, Sienna.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Sarah Leeson, Maya Schwader, and Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week with more Radio Boston.